This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Along with losing weight and leading a healthier lifestyle, one of the top resolutions people make each year is to start managing their money better. And just like losing weight, many people find that resolution hard to keep. But there are methods and resources available to anyone who wants to really learn how to track their finances and manage their investments. Joining us to discuss the outlook for the markets in 2015 and provide suggestions and information that will help you get better control of your finances this year are Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel Vice President and Portfolio Manager Jim Russell, Dale Coates, Vice President and Institutional Portfolio Manager with Johnson Investment Counsel, and Financial Advisor Chris DeSimeo. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jim, Dale, and Chris, thanks for being here this afternoon.
Always a pleasure.
Chris, first let's talk about the latest jobs numbers that came out this morning. They, once again, good-looking numbers.
Another extraordinary report. A lot of people, I mean, if you think the cold weather is breathtaking, and it is,
yes,
the number from last month was so far above estimates that people thought there's no way it could be repeated. And yet, it wasn't so much the fact that this number, the December report, came in above estimates. I think the estimate right at the point was 245,000. It came in at 252,000. So that's close enough for jazz, as we used to say in music school. But it was the upward revision of that already huge number from the prior month. In fact, both the October and November numbers were revised upward by a combined 50,000. So that just kind of took all the you know, jaw-dropping part of the 5.6% number for the unemployment rate itself. Everyone was just focused on those upward revisions. And normally you would think that this would start a rally, but remember, it's the old buy on the rumor, sell on the news. And that plus the terror attacks in Paris have kind of put a damper on things today. The Dow's down about 161 points as we begin this afternoon.
Dale and Jim, what do you think? Are we going to see this kind of jobs momentum continue through the year?
That's a tough call, obviously. We enter 2015 with the best momentum we've seen in jobs, at any point during the economic recovery. In fact, 2014 was the best year now for private sector job growth since 1997, nearly 3 million jobs, 2.8 million jobs created. So it's difficult to expect that we're going to see that repeated. Now that the unemployment rate is down to, as you said, 5.6%, the lowest we've seen since 2008, we would expect a slowing in those numbers. However, one factor that people need to keep in mind is that the participation rate is very, very low today. In fact, the number of people that are participating in the labor market or looking for jobs is at the lowest point since 1978. So if those folks decide to enter back into the market, there could be, again, another surge or a rise beyond 2014 numbers.
And Jim, while the jobs report was good, wages fell in December.
They did. They were down 0.2%, not something we normally see with a jobs number. And 1.7% was the hourly wage gains for 2014, again, right around the inflation rate. So while the politicians will probably claim victory, I think the average Joe is maybe less enthusiastic about what's going on. Agreeing with Dale's comments, though, that I think some of the momentum probably eases just a little bit in 2015 as we move forward. The Fed's probably likely to be active at some point this year, something I'm sure that we'll talk about later in the hour. But it does appear that there's been substantial progress in the terms of the last 18 months to 2 years. One additional thing I would add, and that is regarding the participation rate, and a longer-term look at the participation rate would tell you that since the year 2000, the participation rate has actually been coming down. So we think it's maybe more of a demographic issue as much as anything.
Yeah. To what extent, Dale and Jim, could that participation rate be influenced by the fact that not this year but next year in January 2016, the first wave of baby boomers will actually begin to turn 70? Are retirees putting downward pressure on that participation rate?
You know, we think that they probably are. I think the part-time work that probably those folks bring with them is going to be kind of a new normal that we're starting to see. I know a lot of folks are working part-time and would prefer to work full-time, right? And some of those folks may be kind of easing into a retirement scenario where full-time, part-time, and then something less than that. So we do think that demographics do play in.
The other thing that was interesting is that if you remember back a few years ago, people were worried that as unemployment dropped below a certain level, they just started worrying about something called NARU, not the NARU jackets, but the N-A-I-R-U, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment.
Which we should worry about if those ever come back.
How close are we to having to worry about that? Dale?
Well, as we've just heard, wage gains are really sluggish right now, and there's really no expectation on our end, and we don't see any evidence of it in the economy that's going to accelerate quickly. We are seeing aggregate income growth in the economy, so more people are working. The hours worked have been modestly increasing, fairly steadily. So aggregate income is getting better for the economy as a whole, as Jim mentioned. The politicians are touting that. But the individual family, the personal, no, it's they're slowly growing and unlikely to do so very quickly unless we see more broad increase in inflation.
So, Jim, the total wage increase was 1.7% in 2014, and that's behind inflation, correct? I mean, inflation's running around 2 or a little above?
The headline inflation is 1.7. The core is 1.3, I believe.
Okay.
And so it's right at inflation. So, again, you're running pretty hard just to stay even. We actually think that it's a combination of technology replacing humans to some extent, although that's a slow grind. And also, I think the global wage points are sometimes figuring into some of these industries, depending on where you are. Technology, certainly. Medicine, certainly. Other areas, certainly, where you have a global wage that is much lower than the United States. And so sometimes there is a bit of substitution.
Where should people who are retiring and looking to rebuild an income stream, where should they be looking? The savings accounts are still, you need an electron microscope to check out the interest that you're getting. Interest rates on the 10-year bond right now hovering around 2. Right. And I'm not sure that's more hovering. That's plumbing the depths.
Right.
And then because of the advance in equity prices overall, the average dividend yield of the main index is down also around 2, even though it has the opportunity, never guaranteed, of course, for growth. So if someone's retiring now, what would you recommend? What kind of advice would you have on how to rebuild your income stream?
Chris, is a great question, and it's one of the ones that we hear very frequently from our private client base. And not only that, our institutions as well that are having bonds that were yielding 6-7% roll off.
They're maturing.
And as you mentioned, a 2% yield is kind of par for the course, or even something less than that. Depending on risk levels, there are a couple of different places where we look. Preferred stocks might be one of the areas as an asset class that might hold some appeal.
A preferred stock.
Yes.
Now, for our listeners, explain the difference between a preferred stock and a common stock.
Correct. It's a little bit more senior in the capital structure. Many of the larger companies use this as a financing source. Unlike a common stock, they usually don't trade in a volatile fashion, nor do they raise their dividend every year.
They're contractual usually, aren't they? Or they're set by the original offering.
They are callable in some cases, and so they do trade, but they trade somewhat like a bond, fairly thinly. It's kind of a buy and hold kind of instrument. But some of those yields, depending on where you go, can be appealing in the current environment. We also like a dividend growth strategy. To your point earlier, stocks have had a good period. They have risen very strongly, but we do think dividend yields can easily be found in the 3.5-4% range with annual increases, call it between 4-6%. So again, we think that's an inflation-beating strategy that makes some sense for many people out there.
Jim, one of the savings strategies when I was a kid was just to open a savings account, and I can remember you could get like 5%, 4% on a savings account. So is it safe to say that those days are gone?
Well, you know, everything cycles through, right? And, you know, clearly we're seeing a deflationary global environment. Some places more than others.
Negative interest rates in parts of Europe right
absolutely.
Now.
Absolutely.
Germany.
To the point where it's a problem. So we do think that you never want to say this is forever. Everybody feels that the current environment is going to last forever. Hard to make that call. So at some point, we'll see higher rates. We don't think, to Dale's point made earlier, we don't think it's any time, in the next month or two.
Dale? Let me add to the portfolio basket of ideas from an income perspective. Jim's exactly right. Not only have private clients been forced to pay close attention to what they're spending and perhaps accept a smaller payout, institutions are doing that. Traditionally, institutions may spend 5 or 6% of portfolio value on an annual basis today.
The big trusts and the big charitable endowments and so forth.
The university endowments and so forth. 4% is probably a more rational level that we're seeing many boards move towards. So people are recognizing that you've got to be more cautious about spending. Another portfolio vehicle to include might be master limited partnerships. We do like those.
The pipelines.
These are the pipelines. While they do have some price sensitivity in how they trade relative to oil prices, in reality, their business is much less sensitive to the price of oil itself.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's mind-boggling when you think of upstream, all the activities involving getting oil out of the ground and finding it. And then downstream, that's all of us filling up our cars. Right. But the midstream is just moving it around. And if the economy is not going to be falling into a recession, you would think that the moving oil around and moving gas around business would still be an all right thing. And yet some of these MLPs, Master Limited Partnerships, have just gotten crushed along with the drillers.
Yeah, they have. And in reality, they're a toll road business. They're an annuity. In essence, they get paid by the flow of the energy through the pipeline to the end user. It's like driving across the toll bridge on your way down to Captiva or something. You pay a little toll, you get on the other side, and you enjoy your vacation.
That's unfair to talk about that. This kind of weather.
You know, one of the big pluses for consumers this year has been the decline in oil prices. Does that keep going, Dale? Jim, what do you think?
Oil prices may be going through a bottoming point here. It's hard to know. Commodities are very volatile. They're very dangerous to invest in. That's why you got to be very careful and very diversified in how you do that. And owning good companies who have great management is the best way to accomplish that. But at under $50 a barrel, oil's down 45% in just 6 months. It's hard to fathom
Stunning.
How quickly how quickly and how substantial that is. And it's really a supply-demand issue. Typically, what you would see at this point, and it's driven mostly by more supply than demand. Demand's not really falling off much globally. It's off a little bit at the margin, but in the U.S. it's up. So
yeah. Where do those heating bills show up in your mailbox?
And you'll see why it's up. And so demand's solid, but North America has done a good job over the last 10 years or so of producing more oil and becoming less dependent on OPEC. And yet OPEC this time around so far has chosen not to reduce production to offset that supply. And as a result, the price is dropping.
We will continue our conversation about financial resolutions for 2015 after the break. And you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me this afternoon, Jim Russell with Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel, Dale Coates from Johnson Investment Counsel, and financial advisor Chris DeSimio. What are your financial goals for the new year, and how do you go about accomplishing them? You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. You know, I learned something yesterday on the show, Chris. I always learn something new about resolutions. Did you know that by June, about 60% of those of us who make resolutions have already blown them?
Did you know that 98% of all statistics quoted by economists are actually made up on the spot?
Including ones about resolutions?
No. And I wanted to mention, though, because tonight at 7 o'clock on WVXU and WMUB, this new show about getting inside. Invisibility, is that what it's called?
Yes.
That really sounded interesting because it gets inside. It should be an investment show. Anyone interested in investing should listen to that because it gets into motivation. And that's really, you know, we all have to make a decision to either consume our money or to set it aside for later. And have to figure out at what point do you not want to work so hard for your money?
And there you go.
And how do you do that? And so certainly a resolution always should be, I'm going to save more. But it's not real until you look at your 401k plan, go online and look at either your 401k or your 403b and find the most that you can save into it. In other words, based on your age, how much can you save and try, even if you're not started, try to at least begin the process of setting money aside from your check each and every month, each and every week. And please, if you have an employee match, if your employer will match, at least save up to the amount that your employer is matching. Because if you don't, that's like saying, I don't want the free money you're trying to give me. Please just keep it.
Okay.
And so I think as a resolution.
That's basic rule number one.
Rule number one, don't turn away free money.
What would your rule number one be, Jim?
For 2015, we do think that, you know, for any household, a couple of things are important to keep in mind. You know, we do think in terms of maybe the equity market that probably the big gains have been seen for this cycle. We do look for maybe a bumpier 2015 for a couple of different reasons. We do think that earnings estimates for the market in general, I'm talking about the S&P 500, are perhaps maybe a shade too high. Right now, they're looking for a little bit over 8% in terms of
growth
over 2014. We think that the strong U.S. dollar, which continues to march ahead, will be a little bit of a headwind to that. We're also concerned about growth in Europe. About 34% of the S&P 500's revenue is non-domestic. So call it a third of the typical S&P 500's companies' revenue comes from outside the United States. Japan's in a recession. Europe is essentially there. Russia is slowing. China is slowing. So we're a little concerned about some of the global dynamics outside the United States. We do think the United States will continue to be the best market to actually invest in. But we think it's not going to be kind of a straight-up scenario. We think that, as we've seen recently in the news, terrorism will continue, unfortunately, to be an issue that I think the investment community will have to contend with. Geopolitics, oil, to Dale's point made earlier, there are lots of things in the wind. And, of course, the run-up to the 2016 presidential election will also rear its ugly head as we move forward.
It's already.
So I take it your advice is not to put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah,
cautious.
I love Chris's remarks a minute ago. Saving more money is really the key, and that is making yourself in a marathon run that first step, get started. You know, be aware of where the advantages are, like a employer match, like a tax advantaged account. And get started in that way. Lower gasoline prices will certainly help. There are different numbers that are being thrown around, but we saw that in 2014, when gasoline started to really head south around Thanksgiving, the average household saved about $115. Now, you can't take a cruise on that. But I think you'll see in the retail numbers coming up that the holiday season, shopping season, was a little stronger than it would have been otherwise. Should gasoline prices stay below $2 locally, it looks like the average household will save in the neighborhood of $500, $600, $700 for all of 15. So, again, maybe some good news there.
You know, Dale, as Jim was talking, this fall in the price of gasoline, it almost seems as if you could just follow the money. You can follow the people who are saving money at the corner of Montgomery and Kenwood Road and then just going right to the mall. Are retailers, as a business, something or consumer discretionary names? Are those the kind of thing, without naming individual names, of course? But are the consumer discretionary sector companies something we want to look at? And then also the real estate investment trust area, the people who own the high quality shopping centers. Is that some of these have some pretty generous yields. Is that something that the average investor might want to take a gander at?
Well, they obviously have at this point. I think REITs last year, REITs, as you mentioned, had the strongest year of any asset class.
Double-digit returns.
28%, I think, something along that nature. So investors quickly caught on to that and bid those prices up. We do like the consumer sector, both the consumer discretionary and the more consumer staples type businesses, beverage, food, consumer products and the like. But once again, many of those stocks have performed well. Now, the nice thing about many of those companies is they have very strong cash flows, pay a nice dividend. And as Jim has mentioned several times, dividend growth is an important element to long-term investing. And that would be a good place to go, particularly knowing what consumers are going to do with that extra $500, $600, $700 they're going to save in the next 12 months. They're likely to spend it someplace, and they're going to go out and buy some drinks and dinners and some food and some retail sweaters, shirts, whatnot.
Dale, a real estate investment trust, that gives you specific ownership in real estate. Is that correct?
Well, it gives you ownership in a business that owns and manages real estate. They may own strip malls. They may own apartment buildings. They may own residential. Or they may own office buildings.
Yeah.
They all have their specialty, and they're very diversified, very good managers, so you don't have to manage the real estate
it's
yourself.
It's an indirect way of
it's
owning property.
It's an indirect way of owning property, yes. And again, it pays a decent dividend. They pay a lot of cash flow out, but over time, the stocks have done very, very well.
Yeah, in fact, you can own individual real estate investment trusts that specialize in any given type of property, as Dale mentioned. And you can also own mutual funds of real estate investment trusts. So you can some are quite narrowly focused and others are very broadly focused. So be careful. Do your homework or speak with an advisor such as Dale or Jim before you plunk down your hard-earned money.
But it sounds like it's going to be more diversified and generate income at the same time. You can kill two birds with one stone with a real estate investment trust.
And a lot of these things all the CFA types, the chartered financial advisors in the analysts in the room, it's one of the hardest designations to get, by the way. These guys have studied a lot. But they call it negatively correlated. In other words, they zig when the rest of the market is zagging. And when you imagine this double helix that we all learned about in biology class, if you line one up from the lower left-hand corner of the page to the upper right-hand, that's hard to do on radio. But imagine half of a double helix, and then the other half, if something is always zigging when the rest is zagging, but the main trend is still higher, you can even out the ups and downs and the peaks and valleys.
And that's a real key when you're investing your 401k, 403b plan, whatever it might be, and you're picking funds that you want to invest in. Don't pick all in the same investment approach, investment strategy. For instance, small cap companies that are growth oriented. You'll get good returns one year and horrible returns the next year. They'll be very volatile. But if you diversify into different types of assets that do exactly what you say, zig when the other's zagging and have low correlation, you're going to get a better rate of return in the long run with a more consistency to it.
And especially if you rebalance.
I think that's one of the problems people have when they're setting their financial goals, though, is that they're looking at their 401k and they have this multitude of choices, growth and income, aggressive growth, bonds, high yield bonds. It's a lot of different things. How do people go about knowing what the heck they're doing with those?
Unfortunately, they do it the wrong way. Most people will look at what did well last year and say,
they look in the rearview mirror.
For me.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what they need to do is read the material. Employer's going to provide a lot of good information. The fund managers provide a lot of good information to tell you what the objective of this fund is and how it invests. And the best thing I can advise would be to pick a basket of those, some that might be large companies, some that might be small companies, some that might be international businesses. Mm-hmm. As Jim has mentioned, the U.S. stock market has done so much better than the global markets for so long that at some point that's going to revert itself. And so building into some international investments can be a good way to accomplish that.
And, of course, a lot of it depends on where you are in life, doesn't it, Jim? Your age, how near retirement you are, that kind of thing.
That is absolutely key. Know yourself. Know what you are looking for. Know what you need as opposed to, as mentioned earlier, chasing last year's winner. A lot of the REIT and utility performance, utilities were up 28% last year. Boring old utilities are very correlated, highly correlated to interest rates moving lower. We're not so sure we get a strong bond market rally this year, although I will tell you, let me just be clear, Most people in the investment community didn't think we would get one in 2014, and that's exactly what happened. So it would be a non-consensus expectation for bonds to move materially lower from here in terms of yield, but and higher in price.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Let's talk with Scott and Anderson. Good afternoon, Scott. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hi. Great show. A little bit of it sounds like Greek to me because I'm a little green with this stuff.
Ask a question then.
Yeah. My question is about brokerage firm fees. I've recently inherited about $120,000 in a fairly diversified portfolio, stocks and bonds and government mortgage things. And I was able to get the I asked the brokerage firm what the fees were for this.
And of course, the firm shall remain nameless, of course.
Correct. Yes. But it kind of adds up, all told, to about 2% a year, which to me says it's kind of $2,000 a year for them to just kind of hold this and send me a statement every month in my email. Can I mention a couple of firms?
No, actually. What I would do is this, Scott, there are, it depends on what you're paying for. Most people are in the advice business. And in the advice business, people will charge for their advice. And so a fee-only fund, investment advisor will charge you either a fee by the hour. They'll charge you a fee based on the assets under management. And that fee can range anywhere from, depending on the size of the portfolio, from 0.5% up to 1.5%. In fact, the industry average for personalized financial advice of that nature is about 1.17, I think, according to Morningstar. But the asset management itself, then, depends on the size of the portfolio. So there's asset management. So if you own a mutual fund, whether it's an index fund, you're going to have very low fees. If you have an actively managed fund, those are going to cost more. But then there's the advice of the person telling you which funds to be in. So it depends on what you're getting for what you're paying. If you're getting great value, two may or may not be high. But if you're not getting anything, then two is high.
Scott? Okay. Yes, I mean, there's been very little advice. I just kind of got it, so I'm just holding on to it and seeing what happens. But and they were very upfront when I asked them about their fees.
Sure.
So that was good.
Yeah, Dale.
I would add, Scott. Just transparency is very, very important. I agree with Chris. You get what you pay for. There are times when it's important to pay a fair fee. There's times when you need to keep the cost down. Obviously, in the long run, the lower the cost, the more that you're getting versus those giving you advice. But then again, the advice is valuable. But transparency is the key. If your firm is being transparent with you and they're answering your questions and letting you know up front, then I think that's the right start. If they're not being transparent, that's a different matter.
Yeah, and if they're not doing anything for you, that's another matter. But if you're getting advice and it's tailored to your own situation, then over time you'll have to determine whether that's fair or not.
Scott, thank you very much for the phone call. We appreciate it. Chris, he does bring up a good point. Should that be one of my among my many resolutions financially for 2015? Should I go through and look at what am I paying for my investments, and does that make sense?
There's no reason to avoid that. Morningstar, which we can, that's a research firm. That's a lot of data, a lot of good data. Lipper and Morningstar all do a great job of telling you what an average fee is for a certain kind of fund. Some kinds of mutual funds cost more to manage because there's more work to do. Generally speaking, foreign funds have more restrictions. Every country has its own set of rules. So a fund that invests internationally is going to cost more than a fund that invests domestically. An index fund generally that doesn't have any decision-making going on in it will generally be less expensive internally than an actively managed fund. But it's important to compare similar instruments. So compare actively managed funds with the return and the risk and the volatility and the fee, because just the raw number sometimes doesn't tell the story of the sheer volatility. There are index funds, exchange-traded index funds, that have internal fees of maybe, 8 basis points, 8 one-hundredths of 1%?
That's correct.
They're almost paying.
Some of Vanguard's funds are in that range,
yeah,
and some are maybe even a shade lower than that.
Yeah, and the key is, though, if you are getting into something and getting out of something at the wrong time, the fee is not the problem. You are the problem. So it's there's a big difference. And in fact, some of the research firms actually will post these studies on not only the funds return, but the funds return as money is in it. So are people flying into a fund when it's popular and out of it when it's not? Many times, the exact time they should be buying a good fund with a consistent track record is when a lot of investors, unfortunately, are bailing out.
Statistically on that, Chris, over the last 50 years or so, the average return for the stock market's been between 10 and 12%. But if an investor happened to be out of the market during the 40 days that got the best return, just 40 individual days of that 50 year, you actually underperformed the bond market.
The bond market, not the stock market.
Not just the stock market. Underperformed the return of about 4%. So, again, market timing can be very difficult, very dangerous, and unfortunately, a lot of investors pick the wrong time to both buy and sell.
Well, what do you think about U.S. savings bonds? You used to buy them for kids as a gift. In fact, some people still do that, as a matter of fact. Are those still a good idea as a way to save money?
Well, they're going to be low return, low risk. Today, I think most of the savings bonds you're going to invest in are have a floating rate based off of a five-year Treasury note. Five-year Treasury notes today don't yield a whole lot, about a half a percent or so. So you're not going to get much return. You'll get consistency, you'll get stability, and when and if interest rates rise again, your return will go up with that.
And there is a resource, by the way. It's treasurydirect.gov, where if you have, and we see this a lot, someone passes away and the kids or grandkids are going through the drawers, going through the files, and out comes a stack of savings bonds. And at the Treasury Direct website, you can type in the serial number of these bonds, and they'll tell you, even though it may have matured, they will frequently continue to pay interest until a later date.
And one other thing to add on top of that is if you're pulling out a drawer, mom or dad's savings bonds they bought years ago, many of them actually have a guaranteed minimum yield if they were issued at the right time some point in the past. And that low point might be 4%. A 4% return in the bond market today is very high.
Yeah. So don't be in a hurry to cash those in if you stumble across a treasure chest full of them or just a drawer full of them.
Well, and some of the older ones actually had fairly good interest rates.
They did.
Too.
They did. And they're still around. It's treasurydirect.gov.
And we'll continue our conversation after the break. If you have any questions about achieving your financial goals in 2015, give us a call at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney, and joining me this afternoon, Jim Russell from Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel, Dale Coates with Johnson Investment Counsel, and financial advisor Chris DeSimio. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Chris, when we were talking about making health resolutions on yesterday's show, the one common mistake that kept coming up was trying to do too much at once. So that can set you up for failing and then giving up. And I'm wondering, if, like a lot of the other resolutions we make, does the same apply to financial resolutions? Take them one step at a time?
They do. You should choose a resolution or two that would be achievable, as opposed to saying, I'm going to be worth $1 million at the end of the year. I'm going to beat the S&P by 20 base by 200 basis points. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of great books that are classics that are still good things. Anything by Benjamin Graham, for example. Anything like that makes you a better, smarter investor. Anything that helps you digest the news media a little better. A good resolution is don't just react to a headline, but understand, maybe take an investing class at a local school or adult education and just learn some of the fundamentals. But don't be in too big a hurry to try to become a genius. I mean, there are people who have been in this business a long time who learn something new every day.
I know I'm in that boat.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, it's a good resolution is one that just says, I promise myself I will not let my emotions run away with me while I invest.
And don't let the issue or the fear of failure overwhelm you and stop you from getting started. Mm-hmm. One of the key things we've talked here earlier about, what's the number one thing you should be doing, and I guess it boils down to get started if you're not doing it.
Correct.
If you can save even a few dollars a week and put it aside and build it into a mutual fund, do it. That's going to add up. Statistically, if a young person saves just a few thousand dollars every year, if they can find a way to put it in their 401k plan or put $2,000 into an IRA every year for 10 years, just do it for 10 years, they'll probably retire with about $1 million.
Kind of goes along with an email from Mike. He wants to know, do I have to buy 100 shares of a stock? Does it make sense to buy just, say, 5 shares of Apple or another stock that might have a high price? I guess it goes back to the idea of do what you can afford, little bits at a time.
Do what you can afford, but get started. That's the key thing. And do it in a diversified way. One of the dangers I think people do is they get enamored with one idea, whatever that idea might be. And those who have been around long enough to remember the 1990s remember just how wonderful picking any tech stock was for a while. And then it wasn't so wonderful for a while, a long while, in fact. And so being diversified is very, very important. A mutual fund would be a great way to get started if you've only got a few dollars to save each week or each month.
Yeah.
But there are ways, going back to Mike's email, there are ways that you can I guess it's dollar cost averaging would be what he's talking about, where you can buy a small number of shares or even fractional amounts of shares.
Most, again, if you have an IRA or a profit sharing plan or a 401k or something of that nature, most allow you to dollar cost average weekly, deduct right out of your checking account.
That concept is pretty active and on full display on the 401k that Chris mentioned just a minute ago. That's essentially what you're doing, is putting $100, $200, $50 per week, per every 2 weeks, into an investment consistent with what Dale said. And you buy a few more shares if the price is down, fewer shares if the price is up. That makes all the sense in the world.
And again, getting started is the key. The eighth wonder of the world is the power of compounding income. And people don't realize that if you can get started and let the money work for you, how much more valuable it'll be at the end of the road.
So there are, however, ways where you can purchase just a small number of shares if you go through your brokerage, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of brokerage firms, both online discount brokerages, and also even full-service firms many of them have programs where instead of commissions, individual commissions on trades, you're just paying a fee for asset management. That's especially important if you're investing smaller amounts, because individual transaction costs on a small investment will just eat your return alive. So there are programs that are available to do just that thing.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. And, Chris, there have been several surveys that have been done that show that about 28% of Americans don't have any savings whatsoever for the event of an emergency. Is creating an emergency fund or building up your emergency fund something you should really focus on? Is it a good first goal for someone who wants to manage their money better during the new year?
That is an excellent first goal, having just a cushion of cash that's in a bank somewhere, even though it's not earning much interest. But that's that final barrier that stands between you and disaster, because if you don't have an emergency fund, whether it's $1,000 or $2,000 or $10,000, some people say, well, I need 6 months' expenses. Well, if 6 months' expenses represents, $60,000, that's a lot of money to keep in a bank. You might want to have something other than that. But if guaranteed, there are a few things in life that are guaranteed that like this one is, that if you sell ABC Company, your favorite investment, because you had an emergency, the stock gods will look unkindly upon you, and that stock will double before you get around to buying it back.
You'll sell it at a loss, and then it'll get revenge.
There are a few things
later
that are guaranteed, but that one is. So it's that emergency fund that keeps that from happening.
Yeah, to Dale's point earlier, the compounding effect of any good investment is so powerful over time. You really want to keep your paws off of that investment and let it work its magic. And if you can build a moat, and I think that's a great moat. Metaphor around this, and put some distance between you and being able to touch that, that's going to be the key.
And that emergency fund would be your moat, because otherwise you're always tapping into your stocks, your bonds, and other things. I'm amazed at that. 28% don't have a
paycheck to paycheck. I've seen the statistics too, and it's a scary thought, especially as the demographics, as we mentioned earlier, of this country get a little bit older. That and everybody runs into that: the car accident, the appliance that goes on the fritz,
leaky roof,
etc. Or a college age child that doggone it, just needs another $500.
So should that be your first goal, to establish that fund before you even start thinking about investing, Dale?
Well, you can think of it in terms of three prongs, I think. A young person, particularly getting started today, may have debt, probably student loan.
Exactly.
They're going to have to pay that back, and they're going to have to pay that down at a fair pace. But don't do that to the exclusion of doing these other things, which is putting aside this cash to build in that margin, because life is full of uncertainties and unexpectations that are going to happen to you. And the leaky roof and the furnace that doesn't go out in the middle of January, those things have to be resolved. So accomplish that simultaneously. And then the third prong, of course, is find a way to put some money in retirement plan. And the best way to do that, if you're employed, is through your employer's saving vehicle, hopefully a 401k, 403b, or if they don't have that, an IRA.
Chris, people who've been working for several decades, they might have several 401ks and several IRAs and several other investments. They're kind of all over the place. So should one of their resolutions be getting better organized?
Absolutely. They should be better organized. But one thing that you need to be careful about, and it's not an especially well-known aspect, but if you have a 401k and you're thinking of retiring early or taking a break as you approach 59 and a half, 50, the IRS allows you to turn a retirement plan such as a 401k into a stream of income via a number of different formulas. Section 72T comes to mind. And it allows you access to the funds without a penalty. You still pay tax on it. However, once you cross over into the world of being 55 years and older, then you're allowed to take ad hoc distributions from a 401k plan. It's still taxable, but it doesn't have to be tied to that very strict formula the IRS imposes on those other kinds of withdrawals. So before you pull the plug and roll all of your 401k plan over, if you are not yet 59 and a half, figure out how much you're going to consume in the next 2 or 3 years and make sure you leave that in the 401k. Because the standard advice has always been, oh, sure, just roll it all over. Well, maybe not such a good idea.
Okay. So be careful getting organized, is what you're
saying. Get organized, but do it smartly.
I guess it goes back to the old idea of doing things incrementally and step by step and making sure you're not trying to bite off too much all at once.
Exactly. And if you don't know the answer, ask. Ask someone you know and respect who may or may not be in the business, but get a couple good recommendations and sit down with a professional before you just pull the trigger, whether it's your accountant or your attorney or your financial advisor.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. Let's talk with David in Price Hill. Good afternoon, David. You're on Cincinnati Edition.
Good afternoon. I have a professional money manager that I just started working with last March, and when I decided to go on with them, I said mentally that I would give them 3 years in which to prove their worth, but I really didn't know how long you should give a professional money manager time to prove that they're providing a good service for you.
I'll take a stab at that,
okay,
David.
Jim.
Thank you for the call. I think it comes down to what your expectations are and what they can deliver, and is there a good match? Part of the service provided will be communication, updates, assessments on where you are, what you would like to achieve, and of course the vehicles that are being used in order to achieve your financial goals. Hopefully that is coming into focus and that you're happy with your provider. 3 years might be a pretty good time. 4 years, maybe a little better, even five. 1 or 2 years is probably a bit too short. So I think you're maybe getting into a range where you probably got a good feel for the cadence of communication and the type of style. Dale, do you have a thought?
I would agree with that. You know, when you work with a professional manager, you're asking them to do a couple of things, and you're expecting that. Sit down and talk those through. The planning is one of them, not just the financial planning, but potentially estate planning or long-term planning for other things besides retirement, if depending on the age of your children or the age of your parents, for that matter anymore. And then the objective, the goal. What do you expect to achieve? And be realistic with that. You know, it is unrealistic to expect that you're going to earn 15% per year. You've done that for the last 5 years, possibly, in the stock market. Very unlikely to do that in the long run. Set goals that are reasonable and rational to the investment risk you're willing to take.
Chris, you want to add anything to that?
Well, to that I would just add that if your advisor has outperformed whatever your expectations were, it's never a bad idea to ask, well, how did that happen? And what's the likelihood of it happening again? And if there's been underperformance, then also identify why, because sometimes it's just a very good reason. If your objective is to have income and your advisor recommends things that produce income, well, guess what? Don't be surprised if that portfolio underperforms the S&P 500, because the S&P 500 is not a generally income-generating asset. So understand what you're trying to do first and work with your advisor to make your plan work.
Let's talk with Cody in Delhi. Cody, hi, you're on Cincinnati Edition.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good, thanks.
Well, my question was, I'm actually back in school. I left a full-time job, and I'm full-time in school, but I'm working two part-time jobs to be 40 hours a week. So I don't have retirement or anything like that in either of the positions that I'm in right now. So I know you guys, you kept saying, get started. You mentioned a book by Benjamin Graham, I think. But where do you get started? What brokerage firms do you look at? And if you're only able to save about $40 a month at this point, what's the best way to invest that? What would you guys think?
I would just start with a good mutual fund company. Go to the Lipper or Morningstar. Do some screens. Go to the library. Find some good fund companies. And set aside both an IRA account for yourself, a Roth IRA, for example, and a non-Roth IRA or a non-IRA account. But just get started. But there are a lot of good mutual funds that'll do that for you.
Yeah, Cody, this is Jim. I agree with Chris. I was going to the IRA concept really comes to mind. There are different income limits to allow you to participate in a Roth or a traditional IRA. That's perhaps one of the places where you'd want to start, and also keep a little bit of money liquid to the points made earlier, which is maybe an emergency fund should that car break down or whatever. But again, get started. No amount is too small. That's the key. And to get comfortable making those set-aside kind of distributions to your bank account or to the mutual fund complex.
Let's talk with...
My only other question. I'm sorry.
Oh, go right ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if you guys have a good list of resources or a place where you can find just, good companies to look for or just resources in general.
Here's what I would do, because we can't make specific investment recommendations of individual
right.
mutual funds on the air, but what I would do is go to Morningstar.com as a starting place. It's just one, and Lipper, L-I-P-P-E-R, Morningstar, and just they have various screens you can run where you can say, I want to look at funds that have generated a certain type of return or have expenses falling in a certain quintile, and you'll get a feel for the flow. Pick up Barron's every Saturday. Read Fortune magazine once a month. And even though you might not understand a word, buy it again. Eventually, it will start to sink in. But just get into the flow of the language and the feel for it.
Jim, Dale, and Chris, thank you for joining us this afternoon. We appreciate it. And Cody, thanks for the phone call. Ball & Gaynor Investment Counsel Vice President and Portfolio Manager Jim Russell, Dale Coates, Vice President and Institutional Portfolio Manager with Johnson Investment Counsel, and Financial Advisor Chris DeSimio. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. The producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. The technical director was Kevin Rawinski. Thanks to the WVXU engineering staff, Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike McCanich. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Science Friday next on 91.7 WVXU.